listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2012 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. Richard Ford's new novel is narrated by 15-year-old Dale Parsons, who must learn to fend for himself after his parents are arrested for robbing a bank. How can perfectly good, we can even say normal people, turn to desperate measures to solve the difficulties of their lives? It's a fascinating premise. And if Richard Ford's intention is to ignite the reader's imagination, he has brilliantly succeeded with this book. I have to confess also that I loved this novel so much that I was in deep conflict. I wanted to read it every minute, and I did not want it to end ever. I can see the wallpaper in the little house in Great Falls, Montana, where Neva and Bev and Dell and Berner lived, and the Lutheran church across the street. I feel I have spent a winter in a rundown cabin in Saskatchewan, which I am learning to spell. Thanks to Richard Ford, I know the sounds, the smells, the rhythms of those places, and even the thoughts, perhaps, that the people in those places were thinking. I felt deeply for Dell Parsons, the protagonist of this novel, who loves to read and had little access to books up there on the lam in Saskatchewan because the library in Fort Royal, Saskatchewan, is shut down. Dell peers in the thick glass door, and Richard Ford writes and observes, quote, "The aisles of the empty shelving, the toppled over chairs, the librarian's tall desk turned sideways to the door in the gloom. How happy and fortunate we are that this library that we are in tonight is alive and glowing." The great Irish novelist John Banville, who will be joining us here at Aloud in the fall, ended his review of Richard Ford's Canada in The Guardian with this paragraph, with which I heartily concur. Quote, "Canada is a superlatively good book, richly imagined and beautifully fashioned. Although it is too early to do so, one is tempted to acclaim it a masterpiece. It catches movingly the grinding loneliness at the heart of American life, of life anywhere. As the narrative makes its measured progress, the sadness steadily accumulates, a weightless silt that gets under the eyelids. The final encounter at the close of the book between Dell and Berner is one of the most tenderly drawn scenes in modern literature and could only have been written by a writer of Richard Ford's empathy, insight, and technical mastery." And I am pleased to announce that Richard Ford's this book will be debuting as number 8 on the New York Times bestseller list next week, so we have that to celebrate tonight as well. Richard Ford is a native of Jackson, Mississippi. He now lives in Maine. He's the author of a trilogy known as the Bascom novels, which feature his best-known hero, Frank Bascom. They include The Sports Writer and its sequels, Independence Day, the first novel to win the Pulitzer Prize and the Pen Faulkner Award, and The Lay of the Land. He's also the author of the short story collections Rock Springs and A Multitude of Sins, which contain many widely anthologized stories. Independence Day has been called the definitive novel of the post-war generation, and Ford himself has been hailed as one of the, quote, "finest curators of the great American living museum," which, as a curator, I find really cool, indeed. And in conversation with Richard tonight, he is joined by Michael Silverblatt, who I'm sure most of you know. He's the host of KCRW's famous half-hour radio show, Bookworm. Michael is one of the most meticulous and insightful readers around. He created Bookworm for KCRW FM in 1989, and we're always honored to have Michael join us at Aloud, where he's done many memorable interviews. Now, please join me in the great honor of welcoming Richard Ford and Michael Silverblatt to the Los Angeles Public Library. Thank you.
Thank you, Louise. That's very kind of you. You can see from the passage that Louise referred to and read, I always think of the library as a refuge. I was a child of the library in Jackson, Mississippi in the 50s. It's now the Welty Library. My mother took me there for the most non-literary of reasons, which was that it was air-conditioned. And she could safely leave me there and have a little time to herself. So the library, as you well know, serves many purposes. Thank you all so much for coming. It's a great thrill to be in this precious building with you all. I know how it serves the community. I know how it enriches your lives. It's a thing that needs to be preserved and needs to be supported, and it's so wonderful that you're willing to do it. I know that we are here tonight probably the non-Pritzker invitees. Mitt Romney is here somewhere in the city tonight on the nickel of the Pritzkers, so it's nice that you all are here with me. I'm just going to read to you a few minutes, the beginning of this book, and if I read the beginning of it, then I won't have to do all the blah, blah, blah of telling you who everybody is and who everybody's not. And if, you know, if you can't make the beginning of your novel make sense to a reader, then you're really in a lot of trouble, I think. Could we stop taking my picture? Thank you. First, I'll tell about the robbery our parents committed, then about the murders, which happened later. The robbery is the more important part since it served to set my and my sister's lives on the courses they eventually followed. Nothing would make complete sense without that being told first. Our parents were the least likely two people in the world to rob a bank. They weren't strange people, not obviously criminals. No one would have thought they were destined to end up the way they did. They were just regular, although, of course, that kind of thinking became null and void the moment they did rob a bank. My father, Bev Parsons, was a country boy born in Marengo County, Alabama in 1923 and came out of high school in 1939, burning to be in the Army Air Corps, the branch that became the Air Force. He went in at Demopolis, trained at Randolph near San Antonio, longed to be a fighter pilot but lacked the aptitude, and so learned bombardiering instead. He flew the B-25s, the light medium Mitchells that were seeing duty in the Philippines and later over Osaka, where they rained destruction on the earth, both on the enemy and undeserving people alike. He was a tall, winning, smiling, handsome six-footer. He barely fitted into his bombardier's compartment, with a big, square, expectant face and knobby cheekbones and sensuous lips and long, attractive, feminine eyelashes. He had white, shiny teeth and short black hair he was proud of, as he was of his name, Bev. Captain Bev Parsons. He never conceded that Beverly was a woman's name in most people's minds. It grew from Anglo-Saxon roots, he said. It's a common name in England. Vivian, Gwen, and Shirley are men's names there. No one confuses them with women. He was a nonstop talker, was open-minded for a southerner, had graceful, obliging manners that should have taken him far in the Air Force, but didn't. His quick hazel eyes would search around any room he was in, finding someone to pay attention to him, my sister and me, ordinarily. He told corny jokes in a southern theatrical style, could do card tricks and magic tricks, could detach his thumb and replace it, make a handkerchief disappear and come back. He could play boogie-woogie piano and sometimes would talk Dixie to us, and sometimes like Amos and Andy. He had lost some of his hearing by flying the Mitchells and was sensitive about it, but he looked sharp in his honest GI haircut and blue captain's tunic and generally conveyed a warmth that was genuine and made my twin sister and me love him. It was also probably the reason my mother had been attracted to him, though they couldn't have been more unsuited and different and unluckily gotten pregnant from their one hasty encounter after a meeting at a party honoring returned airmen near where he was retraining to learn supply officer duties at Fort Lewis in March 1945, when no one needed him to drop bombs anymore. They were married immediately when they found out. His parents, who lived in Tacoma and were Jewish immigrants from Poland, didn't approve. They were educated mathematics teachers and semi-professional musicians and concertizers in Poznan who'd escaped after 1918 and come to Washington State through Canada and became, of all things, school custodians. Being Jews meant little to them by then, or to our mother. Just an old, exacting, constricted conception of life they were happy to put behind them in a land where there apparently were no Jews. But for their only daughter to marry a smiling, talkative only son of Scotch-Irish Alabama backwoods timber estimators was never in their thinking, and they soon put it out of their thinking altogether. And while from a distance it may seem that our parents were merely not made for one another, it was more true that when our mother married our father, it betokened a loss, and her life changed forever, and not in a good way, as she surely must have believed. My mother, Neva Camper, short for Geneva, was a tiny, intense, bespectacled woman with unruly brown hair, downy vestiges of which ran down her jawline. She had thick eyebrows and a shiny, thin-skinned forehead under which her veins were visible, and a pale indoor complexion that made her appear fragile, which she wasn't. My father jokingly said people where he was from in Alabama called her hair Jew hair or immigrant hair, but he liked it and loved her. She never seemed to pay these words much attention. She had small, delicate hands whose nails she kept manicured and shined and was vain about and gestured with absently. She owned a skeptical frame of mind and was an intent listener when we talked to her, and had wit that could turn biting. She wore frameless glasses, read French poetry, often used terms like cauchemar or trou de cul, which my sister and I didn't understand. She wrote poems in brown ink bought through the mail, and kept a journal we weren't permitted to read, and normally had a slightly nose-elevated, astigmatized expression of perplexity which became true of her and may always have been true. Before she married my father and quickly had my mother and me, she'd graduated at 18 from Whitman College in Walla Walla, had worked in a bookstore, featured herself possibly as a bohemian and a poet, and had hoped someday to land a job as a studious small college instructor married to someone different from who she did marry, conceivably a college professor who would have given her the life she believed she was intended for. She was only 34 in 1960, the year these events occurred. But she already had serious lines beside her nose, which was small and pinkish at its tip, and her large, penetrating gray-green eyes had dusky lids that made her seem foreign and slightly sad and dissatisfied, which she was. She possessed a pretty thin neck and a sudden, unexpected smile that showed off her small teeth and girlish, heart-shaped mouth, though it was a smile she rarely practiced, except on my sister and me. We realized she was an unusual-looking person, dressed as she typically was in olive color slacks and baggy sleeve cotton blouses and hempen cotton shoes she must have sent away to the West Coast for, since you couldn't buy such things in Great Falls. And she only seemed more unusual, standing reluctantly beside our tall, handsome, outgoing father, though it was rarely the case that we went out as a family, or ate in restaurants, so that we hardly noticed how they appeared in the world among strangers. To us, life in our house seemed normal. My sister and I could easily see why my mother would have been attracted to Bev Parsons, big, plank-shouldered, talkative, funny, forever wanting to please anybody who came in range. But it was never completely obvious why he would take an interest in her, tiny, barely 5 feet, inward and shy, alienated, artistic, pretty only when she smiled, and witty only when she felt completely comfortable. He must have somehow just appreciated all that, sensed she had a subtler mind than his, but that he could please her, which made him happy. It was to his good credit that he looked beyond their physical differences to the heart of things human, which I admired, even if it wasn't in our mother to notice. Still, the odd union of their mismatched physical attributes always plays in my mind as part of the reason they ended up badly. They were no doubt simply wrong for each other and should never have married or done any of it, should have gone their separate ways after their first passionate encounter, no matter its outcome. The longer they stayed on, and the better they knew each other, the better she at least could see their mistake, and the more misguided their lives became, like a long proof in mathematics in which the first calculation is wrong, following which all other calculations move you further away from how things were when they made sense. A sociologist of those times, the beginning of the 60s, might say our parents were in the vanguard of an historical moment, were among the first who transgressed society's boundaries, embraced rebellion, believed in credos requiring ratification through self-destruction, but they weren't. They weren't reckless people in the vanguard of anything. They were, as I said, regular people, tricked by circumstance and bad instincts, along with bad luck, to venture outside of boundaries they knew to be right, and then found themselves unable to go back. Though I'll say this about my father. When he returned from the theater of war and from being the agent of whistling death out of the skies, it was 1945, the year my sister and I were born at the Wurtsmith base in Oscoda, he may have been in the grip of some great unspecified gravity, as many GIs were. He spent the rest of his life wrestling with that gravity, puzzling to stay positive and afloat, making bad decisions that truly seemed good for a moment, but ultimately misunderstanding the world he'd returned home to, and having that misunderstanding become his life. Again, it must have been that way for millions of boys, although he would never have known it about himself or admitted it was true. Thanks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and let me say first that Richard and I have spent all afternoon talking to one another, and that you'll hear the results of that on KCRW Thursday at 2:30, the last 2 weeks in June. We did a double interview, and that will be there for you once you've read the book, which you surely will, because it's one of the really terrific books of the season, of the summer, of the year. You know, it's a real book. As Laurie Moore said in The New Yorker, it's a full meal from one of our major writers, and it's a pleasure to read. Now, you've created these characters, you know, a mother, a father, a son. How much did you know? You told us that they, in the first sentence, would be committing a bank robbery, yeah, and that there would be murders. How much did you know beyond that?
Well, when I started writing this book was in 1989, and I wrote 20 pages, and I was sitting around in a little wheat prairie town in central Montana and waiting for some copy-edited manuscript to come back, and thought to myself, well, it's coming back really slowly. I should write something, and that's what I am, a writer. And so I wrote 20 pages, and then the manuscript came back, and I put the 20 pages in a drawer and then into an envelope and then into my freezer. And all I had was, at that point, a young boy, 15 years old, who for some reason I did not know, goes across the border to Canada because his parents had to abandon him. I didn't know why his parents had to abandon him. I didn't know what happened to him when he got to Saskatchewan. So when I came back around to thinking about this book about 4 years ago, maybe a little longer, I looked at all those pages and all of the 20 years of accumulated notes which I had stuffed into my freezer all that time. And I had a lot of stuff. But I thought, well, why would parents abandon a boy and a girl twins? And so I thought, well, I'd like to write about a bank robbery. So I'm going to make them rob a bank. So It was purely an act of fancy, in a sense, because I thought it would be fun to describe that. So I would make them do it. But you know what? One of the things you and I were saying this afternoon is something that bespeaks the conviction of mine, which is that at the heart of many novels and at the heart of many stories is something that doesn't make sense, something implausible. It's pretty implausible that these people would rob this bank. So what I had to do in writing the story was make that implausibility acceptable and plausible. Because when you do that, because this is something that we do in all of our lives, we're always encountering things in life that are implausible. And we negotiate them in our minds so as to make them acceptable. So that's what I had to do. I had to make that bank robbery be plausible, which gives you, in the middle of your book, some real serious dramatic torque that you can draw on. So.
Now, this book, for a reader, bears as its banner something that should be flying on every page. My impulse to say, Richard, I don't believe you. Mm. And it's a high-flying book because what it is about the need to convince the reader that this next extraordinary, incomprehensible thing is true. In that way, it's kind of like a poem, yeah, where line by line, you don't understand until you do understand. And then it all lights up at once.
If you're lucky.
If you're lucky.
If you're lucky. You have to get lucky. In a way, but I kind of think about novels sort of the way you're describing poems, as pieces of artifice, and that readers come to novels as they come to any piece of art, not because they want to believe in it, but because they want to experience it. They know that they're going to get acted on by me, the novelist, and they're willing to surrender themselves to that, so that what I have to do is try to deliver the goods as much as I can and lean on them and make leaning on them be a pleasure, and because that's what they want. Readers come to novels to surrender to them, and they're not really very skeptical until you put a foot wrong. Then you put a foot wrong, and then skepticism begins, and then something else happens after that, and then your history.
I'm really interested. You see, although you were born in Jackson,
right,
and right about Montana, and here we go over the border to Saskatchewan, I always think of you as a California writer because you went to graduate school
here. I did. For my sins, I went to Irvine. Back when Irvine was about four buildings, and the Irvine Ranch was really a ranch. I used to have a 65 Porsche, and I used to go out driving that baby on the Irvine Ranch, chasing cows, and yeah, it was great. I don't think you can do that anymore. Of course, I wouldn't do it anymore.
But how much of what you are as a writer was in place then?
Gosh, not very much, I think, because I came to Irvine because I had been in the Marines and that hadn't worked out, and I'd been to law school and that hadn't worked out. And one day I said to my mother, we were in Little Rock, and she said, Richard, what are you going to do with yourself, son? And I said, I mean, I could have said anything at that point. And I said, well, I think I'm going to be a writer. And my mother said, you think about the Munch painting, you know, the scream when your mother looks at you and you're not going to get a job, you're not going to be a lawyer, you're going to be a writer. I had nothing, basically, nothing. And when I came to Irvine, I had nothing. All I had was a couple of crummy little stories I'd written in college, and that was the whole of my oeuvre at that point. And I really, zero.
Because when I was reading Canada, you know, this book here, and I thought, gee, you know, this guy's narrative strategies are what Elvis Presley said to Steve Martin. He said, you are oblique. And they're, you know, like oblique in an amazing sense, not like in an I don't get it sense, but like oblique in the way of wow, I didn't know that you could write that way. That's so interesting. And, you know, I always kind of wonder, how did that happen? You know, how does a writer get to have the about-face sensibility that makes him distinctive?
Reading.
Reading?
Which is why we're well-placed here in this building. It was only reading, I think. You know, I grew up down the street from Eudora Welty, and that certainly helped. I mean, she was,
I'll bet.
I mean, she was quite oblique. I mean, she had a way of stringing together stories that were unusual. I mean, I met Faulkner when I was 17.
Did you?
Yeah.
What happened?
Well, nothing. He didn't. There was no laying on of hands, but you know. And I don't really know that this answers the question, but literature was in the air in Mississippi, so that when you decided to make that big turn away from regular ways of earning a living, there was an already built-in permission in the town that said, this can be done. So in a way, it gave a sort of license to whatever were one's most native abilities to put stories together. But then after that, I mean, I was dyslexic, and so I had to read really slowly, and I still read about as slowly, silently, as I do aloud. So, those things, I don't know. But the other thing is, Michael, I think everybody who writes novels and writes stories, probably from one time, one book to the next, writes them differently. That the way this novel is put together may be actually different from the way the stories and A Multitude of Sins are put together. And you find your way, I suppose. Otherwise, I don't know. I can't ascribe it to anything because none of my teachers ever taught me to do anything like that. They taught me plenty at Doctorow at Oakley Hall, but they didn't teach me that. I think you probably could teach somebody that, just nobody taught me.
I want to, since the name came up, and I'm always a believer in the respect for writers. For many years, Oakley Hall was one of the two teachers at Irvine.
Right, and a wonderful teacher.
He wrote a spectacular Western called Warlock, which was the year it came out, of all things, Thomas Pynchon's favorite book. And the book is back in print, and it has the most beautiful, invented Western dialogue, side of True Grit.
It's absolutely true.
So I want everyone to know about Oakley Hall. He passed away, but, you know, we don't want our writers to pass away and be forgotten. We want their reputation to begin then and there. Was he a fantastic teacher?
He was a very empathetic teacher, is what he was. He didn't try to manhandle you. He didn't try to make you do things that weren't native to you. I think what he taught me more than anything in the world was how to be. He taught me how to conduct myself in the world as a writer, which is to say, to be respectful of my colleagues, to read a lot, to think that literature is worth your life, to not be skeptical about it, to work really hard, to be relentless. All of those things were strings that needed to be plucked in my little liar. And so he was in that way instrumental. And just, you know, so much of your life when you're writing books is not spent at your desk. Sort of a pitiable amount of time actually is spent at your desk. And so the rest of the time you're kind of walking around the streets being a writer who at that moment is not writing. And so you have to sort of contain yourself and be a regular kind of person, which I, needless to say, am. And he was too. You could play tennis with Oakley. You could talk to Oakley about all kinds of things. It was never the novelist is now getting up in the morning and the novelist is now. It wasn't that way. It was just being a human being. That's what Oakley, what greatly was.
I love the idea of being taught to be relentless. You seem to be, in addition to relentless and something of a transcendentalist, a stoic?
Well, I think that's my facade. I think I'm not really stoical at all, but I like to give the impression that I'm stoical. But I am relentless, and I think maybe relentless and stoical can kind of be confused in a way. Uh-huh. I would like to think of myself as more of a libertine.
In what way?
Well, in all the ways that you could be one.
All the ways? that's
Stoicism is a nice facade.
Uh-huh. And beneath it, libertinism.
Yeah.
Oh, that's, you know, because you guys all know that, you know, but beneath the surface of any novel is the thing most opposed to that surface. So, you know, I think it's fabulous to think of a Stoic who has a libertine right underneath.
Living inside.
Yeah.
Encaged
inside. Yes, yes, yes. Seductive and ready with all of the equipment of seduction. Yeah. So, and is that, I think that must be part of the team. Relentless and seductive, you
Maybe
know?
So.
It ensures success.
I don't want to go very far with this, Michael. There's nothing good waiting for me at the end of this conversation.
I'm just funning around. This is a writer whose every book has been dedicated to his wife.
Right.
So that's, you know, there's a limit. Now, unless that's a facade, too.
No, that's not a facade. No, I dedicated all these books to my wife. Because the first time I ever said to her, we were just about to get married. It was in 1968. And I told her, I said, I think I'm going to try to be a writer, in case you're wondering what I'm going to do once we're married. And she said, oh, that's great. She said, do that. And that's just the magic touch there for me. Do that, she said. That I'll get a job. I'll work. You stay home and write stories. That'll be great. Sometimes when I have students, they say to me, what should I do to get my writing life underway? And I always say, well, you should marry Christina Ford.
I hear that she's not just your first reader, she's your first listener.
Yes, I read all these books to her aloud. I read that book to her aloud last July. Takes a month or sometimes 5 weeks, all day, every day. She holding a manuscript, I holding a manuscript. I'm reading aloud, she's reading along with me, and we're just sort of looking at it through the course of that month or 6 weeks, yeah.
That's amazing. Does it ever go off track where both of you realize, hey, this has departed from its course, we need to sit down and work it again right from here?
It never has happened. I'm pretty diligent about that. I'm pretty diligent about keeping the book on track. I think if I wasn't good about that I wouldn't be a novelist at all. That's really one of the, I think, basic requirements to keep your book on track. I mean, it would be for me a disaster if it went off track. I mean, we have a lot of. Needless to say, after you've worked on a book for a long time and suddenly you find yourself at the end of its life reading it aloud to someone, you find a lot of things that you wish you didn't find, and I'm sort of fulminant about those things. I lose my temper a lot and break a lot of clipboards over my head sometimes. and she just says, well, come on, go back and read that again. Yeah, she does.
Oh, wow. Does, you know, that sounds like my mother. You know, when I had done my homework sloppy, she'd tell me to rewrite it so that if the teacher collected it, it would look pretty on the page.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
It's terrifying to have that standard of perfection, not just your own, but an outsider's.
But it's also very, as your mother would have said to you if you'd said that to her, it's very saving too. Because one of the things Christina believes is that she doesn't want Michiko Kakutani to be the one to tell me that something should have been different. She although of course she will tell you that, no matter what. But she said it's better if I tell you before it gets to the stage when somebody else can pluck it up and say this is a mistake. Yeah.
Yeah. The news that this book is a bestseller, it just arrived today, am I right?
Yesterday.
And what is that? Feel like
it's terra incognita to me. Believe me, I've
this is the first time.
Well, I've had this. Independence Day was on the list for a little while, and The Lay of the Land was on the list for a little while, but never at 8. I mean, I talk about these things as though I know what they mean. I know it makes everybody at the publishing house really happy. Truth to tell, for me, my greatest pleasure is in getting to write this book and to be in the middle of it. At this stage in its life, I want it to do well, but I want it to do well because my publishers are working really hard to publish it, and they've taken a lot of risks with this book. As you know, it's difficult to publish books successfully now. So I want them, because they're a little imprint at HarperCollins, I want them to do well because I want them to feel like, you know, they're doing the right thing with their lives. And I'm happy that I'm the recipient, but I'm as interested in them as I am interested in myself. Yeah.
Well, you see, as you can, Richard and I have known each other
for a long time,
you know, since I think Rock Springs. As you know, I rarely get to talk to someone whose work has hit the bestseller list because I choose the serious and good novels in America. That's my job.
Well, I apologize.
but it's such a pleasure for me, you know. I just think, well, you know, if you stay at it and you're diligent and all the rest, you know, sure enough, it happens.
Occasionally, it does.
Occasionally.
You know, but there are, I have noticed in the last few years with Jeff Eugenides and Laurie Moore and Jonathan Franzen, there are literary books that somehow find their way into being read a lot. I mean, I think it's a phenomenon nobody understands how this can happen, but it is certainly a phenomenon which comes about because the books have been published rigorously and have been supported rigorously. That I'm sure of. So I don't know. I always felt hopeful about it.
I want to point out this cover because it's one. I'm fascinated by book design, and you'll never guess what it is unless you've looked at it closely already. This is a close-up of a maple leaf, which, yes, of course, since the book is called Canada, the maple leaf is on the Canadian flag. But look at this spectrum. I mean, look, you know, there are tinges of red in Richard Ford's name and going from yellow to orange. I mean, it's a gorgeous cover, but I think that it is significant to the book because this is a book that begins to come into focus as you examine it closely. In a certain sense, it's about not knowing what you're looking at. And as we said earlier today, I like to think there's a fabulous goose hunting scene. And as you know, goose hunting takes place with the hunters in what's called a blind. And I think of the readers as being in the blind, that as you move through the book, you see it up closer and closer, and its design becomes clear, and that's what makes it so exciting. I mean, I love this cover.
Thank you. Me too. There were a lot of fighting went into the making of that cover. A lot of what they call pushback in the publishing world.
What's pushback?
Well, they had a lot of ideas for this cover that I kept throwing out and throwing out and throwing out and throwing out. I mean, they wanted pictures of wheat fields and barns and old barbed wire fences, and I kept saying, no, don't illustrate my book, just give me a good cover. But that's okay. I mean, if that's a conversation that you have with them, and my problem is I don't have any ideas, all I know is what I don't like. But to their credit, they came up with, people at Echo came up with that cover. Absolutely. I had nothing to do with its particular genius.
I want to point out, I think it's interesting, the head editor at Echo, who I, although he hates it, have called Danny.
I call him Danny.
Oh, no, he's not fond of it. I mean, I met him when I was 17 years old.
You know,
it was an accident. And I've been calling him Danny, and I can't get used to calling him Daniel. But he began as a poet.
Yes.
Then he published a literary magazine, a fabulous literary magazine called Antaeus. Then that became a press called Echo, and then they, at HarperCollins, bought Echo. So we've watched this extraordinary thing, which I think at its core, you see, this is a poetic image. And I think what Richard was talking about a book beginning in something incomprehensible. That's the way a poem works.
Absolutely.
For a poet developing it. And I think that most of the great American writing that I care about at any rate is written by people who started out by being poets, like Faulkner was first a poet, a symbolist poet, and Melville, poet. It's sort of astonishing that our great American novels, for all the talk about American realism, are poetic novels.
Yeah. You know, there's a line of Neruda's in which he says that he knew when he was going to write a poem because he had a kicking in his soul. He said he had some commotion going on inside of him which didn't have a vocabulary and which he couldn't identify, in which the writing of which was giving body and giving language to something which up to then didn't have it. And it's very much like writing novels, although it takes a lot longer to do.
Yeah, and Faulkner said that it was like building a chicken coop in the middle of a cyclone.
Well, he had a way with those kinds of words, you know. I guess my thinking about it is a little more down to earth.
Huh? What could be more down to earth than a chicken coop? He just had to bring the winds up, you know. But is it down to earth? Is it a down to earth procedure? I guess it is.
I think it is. It's very much day to day. You're mostly consumed by everyday's chores, and trying to make that day be a day you can save. You know, most of the time that one is writing a novel, what you're trying to do is find the right word for something. That's kind of what it is. I mean, you have high aspirations. You assign for yourself where you want your novel to go and what you think it's about. But in the doing of it, it's very much trying to find the right word for something.
Now tell me, how much living of daily life can get done when you're writing a novel?
A lot.
Can you?
A lot, yeah, absolutely. In fact, for me, it's kind of essential. I think life is first and art is second. So I really want to be living the life. I want to get up in the morning and do things and have a nap in the afternoon and have a drink at 5 o'clock and play squash. And I writing a novel for me, even though it may occupy 5 or 6 hours a day, are the hours that I have available to it, really and truly. Whereas I'd often rather be doing something else.
Now, as you're working on a novel like this, when I say a novel like this, I mean that I really think that this book is his very best book. So,
did you like the other books? Was there something wrong with the other books?
No, nothing wrong.
You were so nice about them when we talked about it.
Yeah, well, but I guess, you know, as my expectations mount, and so a novel has to do an awful lot.
Yeah.
By the time I've read 5 or 6 books by the same person, I'm expecting, the whole world or, Alibaba Cave.
It's probably true for most novelists, too. One of the reasons that you keep doing it is everything begins to be preliminary to the thing that you're doing now, which is to not cast shadows on the thing that you did before. But if you're going to keep on doing it as you get older with diminishing abilities, you really want to make it better if you can.
So I imagine that when you're working on a new one, you have to be ever more ready to brave not knowing what you're doing until you do. At what point in this did you feel that you had a clear vision of what it is?
Pretty early. Because I had all of those years of thinking about it, had all of those 20-plus years of thinking about it to have it sort of steeping in my brain. I mean, I knew what its principal metaphorical structure was. I knew where I wanted it to end. I knew what I wanted to happen. Most of what goes into actually writing a novel for me is writing the ligatures between the things that you know in advance, connecting the things that you know are the institutions of your book, the whole issue of crossing a border, having a bank robbery, having murders at the end, having it end in Windsor, Ontario. Then the writing is the connecting of those things for me. And indeed, you don't want, or I don't know when I sit down to do those things, how it's going to work out. And sometimes it doesn't work out, and you have to rub everything out and do it again. But I kind of always know. I wouldn't be good to do what Henry James said was just right toward the dark, right into the dark every day. I don't think I'd like that very much.
Well, you know, because I think that one of the things I'm finding, you know, although they talk about how hard it is for a first novel to get published, I've never received more in the mail than I'm getting now. I mean, I think that there's people are talking out of both sides of their mouth. But at the same time, one of the things that I discover that young novelists in particular don't know is this thing that you just called the principal metaphorical structure of the novel. Yes, there's a plot, but underneath the plot, there's the principal metaphorical structure.
Right.
What is that? What is that thing?
Well, in this book, it was the whole, it sounds very commonplace, it was the whole principle of crossing borders, moral borders, psychological borders, national borders. I'm making it sound very dull when I say that. but there was something about crossing a border when I first thought of it that made that little kick happen in my soul, what Catherine Ann Porter called a commotion. When I feel that commotion, I think that's something I have to put in play. I have to have people cross borders, and I have to have them talk about crossing borders and think about it and see what the consequence to crossing borders is. And then what I find is that if that seems interesting to me, then it comes through the story all the way. And that's its principal metaphorical structure for me. But, I mean, when I hear myself say that, I think about English 101 and reading somebody's novel and, you know, diagramming it in terms of its principal metaphorical structure, which doesn't have very much to do with the passion and the exuberance and the zeal that goes into actually getting to write that.
Yeah, well, you see, I think that principal metaphorical structure sounds like a very boring thing.
It does,
but what
I'm
you're really talking about is the inside of a novel that moves not the characters around, that's a physical procedure, it's what moves the writer from day to day. It's depth of feeling,
exactly.
I think.
Because that depth of feeling has to do with whatever you have felt, again, that doesn't have a vocabulary. When I was writing Independence Day in the 90s, the word independence kept turning up in my notebooks. and I kept saying, well, what's this about? Because I knew all of the conventional definitions of independence, and I thought, well, I need to put this word in play, and if I can put it in play in all the ways that I said, have people speak it, have people talk about it, then maybe I can cause the book to describe something about it that I didn't know before I started to write it. It's one of those ways in which you hope that a novel will make you smarter than you are, by being involved in that hot crucible of work every day.
Final question before we turn it to the audience. One of the most mysterious border crossings in this novel, as before in others of your work, is the crossing of sexual borders.
Right.
Once the character in the second part of the book comes to Canada, he enters a world where most of the men, especially, are thought at one point or another to be homosexual. One of the men wears makeup and eyeliner and lipstick sometimes.
Yeah.
And there are no explanations.
Right.
We're never given the background story for that. That kind of the wording coate comes to mind.
It does to me too.
Yeah, of sexual exploration. Can you tell me about that?
Well, it's just fun to write. You know, it's just literally fun to write, to sort of blur the conventional notions of sexual identity, of sexual appearance, and not trying to blur the fact of the lives of the characters themselves, but blur the sense of perception. When you make those kinds of gestures, there's a character in the book who's a Métis, which means he's half Native American and half Native Canadian in this instance, and half French. I was writing him, and I thought, gee, it would be interesting to make him wear eyeliner or make him have rouge on his face and make him have a sort of apparently feminine kind of affect. I don't know why that was interesting to me. It was just something that seemed instinctual to me, and I just did it. And when I did it, I liked it, and so I kept it. But I do think that it is, as I said to you this afternoon, he's kind of a slightly villainous character in this story. And I think that drama is interesting when villains say things that are interesting and true. And what I guess I was trying to do was create a kind of conventional response to him in the reader and then have him able to be someone who said true things and were interesting. And in that way, it tries to contravene whatever might be your conventional response to somebody who looks like him. So it was more something that was thoroughgoing in the whole notion of literary character than it was particularly interested in sexual identity.
Well, Richard, let's see what these good people have to ask. And thank you.
And let me just say, do you all know in this community what a treasure you have in this man? Yes, ma'am.
I'm sneaking in the first question here. Thank you both so much for coming and speaking. Richard, this is a question I hope you can explain. You use this, and I thought of this all through the book, you use this foreshadowing where you tell us what's going to happen and then it happens. And it doesn't seem like that should work. It doesn't seem like that should be dramatic. Although I found myself going like, don't do it. Don't do it. Don't rob the bank. I mean, can you talk a little bit? I mean, is there a tradition of doing that in writing dramatic fiction? What makes it work?
It's just coarse, Louise. It's just a kind of grocery, really. I wanted to spill the beans on what was going to happen in this book, and the beans were, rather than hold it in abeyance, you know, but rather than develop it so that we blunder into it, I wanted to spill the beans about the robbery and about the murders so that I could then concentrate on what was more interesting to me than those events, namely the consequences to those events. That was much more in my interest than just the working out. But I also thought, you know, it's kind of an old-fashioned narrative hook in a way. There's going to be a murder come along here pretty soon, so you'd be thinking about that for the next, you know, 350 pages. And it just seems kind of a no-brainer to me. So it was foreshadowing, it was just getting that out of the way, but also taking advantage of the anticipation it would create in the reader, which I thought it did if I could make it pay off. I mean, you know, it's the old Chekhov, you know, rifle on the wall, it needs to go off. Or if it doesn't go off, it needs to not go off in a really significant way. But in this case, both of those do go off. Yeah. I don't think it was. Yes, ma'am.
Could you expand a little bit on the counsel that Del gets from different people, from Mildred, about not dwelling too much on one thing, keeping things open, to Ruskin about connecting unequal things, and his mother's advice about backwards thinking?
I wanted him to emerge from an environment where he was loved and where he had access to good advice from people, so that at the end of the book, and the book has an ending which Michael and I have slightly disagreed about, but not profoundly, only slightly. I think it has an affirmative ending. He thinks it's a sadder ending than I do, but I think it's a very affirmative ending. So I had, in a way, the responsibility, if I was going to make that an ending of affirmation, to have something in the book to draw upon, so that back in his life there was some resonant experience that would make it plausible that he could reorder his life and live successfully into his late age. So that's really what it was. What interested me was again, in the idea of crossing borders, was that, well, I'll put it to you. There's a line of Henry James in his little introduction to what preface to what Maisie knew. And he says, there are no themes so human as those that out of the confusion of life show the connection between bliss and bale, between the things that help and the things that hurt. And what was interesting to me about that is how near disaster is from regular life. That if you step across the line, you look back across that line, as we all do when we make mistakes. And we look back at the day before we make this mistake, and we think to ourselves, God, that day, I hadn't done any of this yet. If I could just go back over there and be in that place. But you can't then. So in a way, I was very interested in how regular life just sometimes helplessly moves into very extreme and not regular life. And so I had to establish that sense of regular life for myself. Thank you. Yes, ma'am.
Hi.
Hi.
Michael, Mr. Silverblatt, thank you for your show. You said earlier on something to the effect of every great novel has sort of the opposing force to its surface, underneath the surface. And I wondered if you wanted to say a little more about that. And Mr. Ford, how you feel about that? What do you think about that?
Well, I'll tell you. On the phone at home, I'm not as nice as I am on the radio. And I did find myself telling a publicist, you know, I am interested in my show in talking to the authors of potentially long-lasting and great literature. And if you look at the archive, and 23 years worth of that show is on the archive. You know, you go to kcrw.com/bookworm, you'll find 23 years of interviews with amazing people. And I'm not trying to talk to Richard Ford, Gunter Grass, and Doris Schlumpfert. You know, I'm trying to find the really great writing, and what it comes in the mail is young people chasing their career in New York City. That's not automatically a bad subject for a novel, but there has to be something more, something that makes it other than a sitcom or even a book of amusing short stories. You know, there was a pretty terrifically funny novel called Then We Came to the End that was on the bestseller list, but it wasn't really significantly different from the TV program The Office. It seems to me at the heart of a novel is a contradiction, an incomprehensible contradiction that the author, it's like that Frenchman who went between the Twin Towers, that you're suspended, that there's something beyond your rational sense, that it's not just the connect the dots of plotting. It's something that indicates that, like a human being, a novel has something like a soul. We don't know what the soul is. We sort of do a little bit better at saying what the human heart is, but you know that somehow or other, the mysteries need to be reached or alluded to. I think it's Nathaniel Hawthorne who relayed to Herman Melville the fact that Hawthorne's wife, Sophia, she said, "Tell Herman I liked his novel about the whale." And Herman Melville said to Nathaniel Hawthorne, who, by the way, he had a crush on, a frequently elided fact in American literature, he said to Hawthorne, "Well, tell her that if she liked the novel about the whale, she will like the new novel I am working on, which is like a cup of country cream." And then to Nathaniel, he said, yes, if there is the whale that is the demon of the deep, there is also the kraken, which is the most invisible monster. And the novel was Pierre, a novel that we don't read much, right, but from which we're still recovering. Thank you for asking.
My view of that is probably simpler than Michael's. If there is this sort of two-layered notion of underneath and up above, for me it's a sort of a vision of what existence sort of is, and it's that sort of ants on a cupcake. That seems to me to be sort of what it is. It's just like that. It's teeming stuff without any organization and everybody going for the sugar. And so what I think that you can't live that way. You can't live very long that way. And that what you have to do is to institute some kind of plausible way of both seeing that fact of life and maybe erecting some kind of edifice for yourself to live into it, so that you don't immolate yourself, so that you find some strategy for surviving, and that the novel, in its provisional way, and it's always provisional, it's never the absolute, gives you some evidence that this can be done. I mean, there's a line of Sartre who says that to write about the darkest possible things is fundamentally an act of optimism, because it suggests and proves that these things can be thought about. And that's what novels really do. They want to say, given life, you can also think about this.
That's beautiful. Yeah.
I don't think I thought of any of it. I just probably read it someplace.
Hi there. You just briefly mentioned Chekhov, and one of my favorite books of recent times is the edition of Chekhov stories that you edited, which I thought was just a superb collection. I keep it in my nightstand.
Thank you.
Could you talk? It sounds like you came to Chekhov a little bit late in your career, but can you talk about the influence he's had on you?
Actually, you know, one of the things I said in that introduction is when I read Chekhov, I think, which is largely true for most of us, we're too young when we read Chekhov. We come to Chekhov and somebody's teaching it to us, and all of its mysteries remain intact. and you come away thinking, well, I've read Chekhov now. Yes, Chekhov's very important. I haven't got a clue about any of it. And it's only in a sort of a creative way that you begin to sort of see what makes Chekhov interesting, which is why his famous story, Lady with a Pet Dog, is such a wonderful, wonderful story, which is, I don't know how many of you know this story, but I won't do it any justice by paraphrasing it. But it is about two people who have an affair, and then they go back to their lives, and then they again see each other, then they go back to their lives, and then they see each other, and it becomes clear at the end of the story that they're probably not going to ever be together, and yet there is something compelling to each the other about whatever it is they have. And that Chekhov manages to make what in that instance conventional wisdom seem to be something shabby, not be shabby, but at the same time understand that it carries with it a burden, it carries with it a responsibility, that it is never going to find complete fruition, and yet it is something. So that kind of subtlety, you know, is not ordinary. To say there's something good here amidst all of these things that convention would tell us is valueless and not perpetuating and yet must be dealt with is a kind of intelligence that I like. Because it makes what it makes us do, as which all great literature makes us do, it makes us pay attention. It basically says to us, you think you see something? Let me tell you something. I will show you what you need to see so that you then can pay attention to your life in a way that makes it less like ants on a cupcake. Okay. Yes, sir.
You know, I wrote poetry for 40 years and just turned to prose in the last 8 years.
Well, you're ready now.
I'm ready, right. But, and I've come, Gary Snyder was the last time I was here. And novelists talk about how they do what they do when they talk at these places, which is fascinating to me. Poets don't seem to do that. And a lot of poets started, a few of that you mentioned, Falcon, among others, started out writing poetry. And even Joyce did. Joyce wrote Penny a Piece. Mm-hmm. And then they end up writing prose. But I don't see any novelists turning to writing poetry when it gets... when they get over the hill or wherever they go. yeah, well, you know, I went to school with Richard. My mother asked me when I told him I was going to be a poet, do you have a sexual problem?
Sorry.
Is that it?
But, I don't know. I mean, I have tried to write poems. I love poetry. My, you know, Galway Connell was my teacher. Donald Hall was my teacher. Galway wrote a novel, Black Lights, wonderful. Yeah, nice. I don't know why they don't write novels, because they certainly are ready to do it. I mean, frankly speaking, monkeys can write novels. Plenty of monkeys do write novels. But I don't think, I think it's, they're easier to write than poems. It's just, by my experience, it's just easier to write. I mean, I can always write one terrific line, but I can't write two. But I can write some good sentences that I can sort of string together. But lines are, impose such a responsibility on the reader. They impose such a responsibility on the poet herself. Yeah.
I think also, to be fair, plenty of poets talk very well and richly about what they do, but not in public.
Oh, that's interesting.
And, you know, I think part of the reason is that it involves a whole vocabulary, that if a poet were to come here and tell you about how this sound moved through the first stanza in the second stanza and how he decided on terza rima and how he decided that the, you know, the line breaks would follow an alliterative pattern, you'd be sitting there thinking, like most things, you see, most things in our lives, you'll pardon me, I don't think it's a secret, are impenetrable to laymen. We have vocabularies for physics, and we expect to, for high finance, and we expect to. People expect a poet to have the simplicity of soul of a complete fool. And so they come, and if a poet starts to talk technically about what he does, he's spoiling the trick. Like a magician, you don't give the trick away. You know, novelists have a much easier time talking about what they do. It has to do with stories, and we tell stories and lies every single day. You know, that we perform many of the acts a novelist performs. I mean, most novelists, other than, say, John Barth, when they're talking to you, don't use the word aposiopesis. But there are formal terms for each and every turn within a novel. Sometimes we know them, but most of the time we don't need them. Over the 23 years of Bookworm, I had to teach myself through hard lessons to stop using that fancy vocabulary, because readers like to think that it's all as easy as falling off a log, that it's part of American folklore, that all you have to do is to be able to dream, all kinds of things. You could examine the mythology that anyone could write a novel. Just think of what happened when word processors became available to the general public. Everyone started writing a novel, and the result was wildly deplorable to the state of novel writing. It's not a gift that's widely shared, and the people who write novels are hugely gifted. Despite this man's extraordinary claim of being unintelligent, that ants on a cupcake thing, you know, that's why he's the novelist and I'm the sort of literary critic type. That did it all in around, what, 6 words? Ants on the cupcake, 4. That's really the truth. And we all like to think that our artists are not deeply, deeply gifted people with a great perceptual knowledge of what they do. Putting it into words may be a different story, okay? That's what I think.
But you know, I'll say one thing. There are a few poets who have written, who have talked about writing poetry. Randall Jarrell being one. A wonderful little essay also.
Good for you.
Randall Jarrell was a critic. He was a good, maybe not a great poet, but an awfully good poet. He wrote really wonderful things that permitted you entree into what it was like to write poems. And so did Dick Hugo, as a matter of fact. Dick Hugo has a wonderful little essay called The Triggering Town, which you probably know, which really talks about things very intimate in the writing of poems, which he makes seem rather commonplace. Why they don't do it a lot, I don't know. I'm willing to subscribe to your view that they see it as something so arcane that they can't really articulate it.
Who here are aspiring writers? Just raise your hand. I'm not going to make you do anything. Because I did want to say that, Rilke's book, The Letters to a Young Poet,
it's quite good.
And something that's hardly known, but I just want to tell you about it in case you don't know it. A woman named Carolyn Gordon was given the manuscript by Flannery O'Connor to her book Wise Blood, and she commented on it chapter by chapter, and those notes were republished in something called the Georgia Review, and I've never seen them since, but they're the most practical-minded notes by a woman, Carolyn Gordon, who was herself a would-be novelist, published several novels, but not as good as Flannery, and she's telling Flannery, you're too brilliant here. Tell him what you're going to tell him. Tell him and tell him that you told him. Be like any Southern preacher. That's what you need to do in this chapter. And then, sure enough, like the opening sentence of your novel, Flannery O'Connor begins a chapter. In the morning, Hazel Motes would wake up, fix himself some coffee, go to the zoo, look at the animals there, and identify with them. And then she takes him on that trick. Pretty soon, he's looking at a monkey. And, a whole set of evolutionary and crazy things occur in this vision. But the chapter works because the reader knows where the chapter is going to go. These rules are pretty simple, pretty thrilling. They shouldn't be given away because if they fall into the wrong hands, what would happen to the earth, there are things that no one should be taught.
One more question we have.
Right over here.
Yes, sir.
Given the rarefied level of this conversation, I hate asking this, but Mr. Ford,
all right.
What is your reaction to the fact that three of the novels ahead of yours on that bestseller list are characterized as being pornography?
I haven't looked at that list. Great. I'm sort of a freedom of speech kind of guy about things like that. It must be something people want to read, or they wouldn't be there on the list where it is. I mean, what? I don't read pornography, so other people do, I guess. It doesn't bother me. I don't wish to say, they should be below my novel because my novel is literary quality. I just think, it represents what people want to read, and it doesn't represent a moral position for me. It's just,
Thank you for this evening.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. The Aloud theme was composed by Larry Karish.